A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hey, Herman and Corin. So I'd love to chat today, yesterday's episode about sleep and sleep medicine being this kind of semi-elusive discipline, or, you know, we know that it exists, but it's sometimes really hard to find access pathways that we can afford. And I found out there was a number of things I found really informative about that episode. The first being that sleep medicine is a subspecialty, and that therefore the specialty that comes before that is going to bring a totally different frame of reference to how you practice it. And what I liked about it, actually, was how you mentioned that even people who you might think have nothing to do with sleep, like people who are making devices for sleep apnea, are increasingly being seen as important parts of the conversation. So on the one hand, I guess from a patient perspective, it's more diffuse. It's less clear who exactly you go to, because we, you know, nobody wants to just have their sleep looked at from a purely psychiatric or purely physical standpoint. On the other, I think it creates a broadening of the potential path for treatment. And we talked yesterday in the context of a very different conversation about therapy, about how I personally feel like that layer of what I would call waypointing or signposting is the one where I personally intuitively going on nothing but vibes, as Herman would often say. I feel like AI can be the most useful there. I always think AI will be, you know, has to be subservient to humans in terms of it's a tool in, you know, in the treatment by talented people. But I think there's a lot to be said for the fact that humans tend to have specific interests, and that something that has a very broad view, a bird's eye view, might be a useful tool for clinicians in saying, oh, why don't we look at the anatomical aspect here for sleep apnea? And maybe, you know, that's a consult with a dentist. Because when we talk about sleep drugs, and I mentioned that I'm kind of at the end of my taper with Seroquel, this is a really hard part. I don't mind sharing exactly where I am with it. As I've shared so much on this podcast, I'm at like 25 milligrams, which if you ask most doctors, especially even those who might use it for the normal indication of schizophrenia, would say that's like saying you drink 1/50th of a cup of coffee and you feel you can't go to sleep. That's microscopic. And I don't feel like it is microscopic, but when we talked about the pharmacokinetics, the metabolite effect, it made me feel less crazy, because it's that kind of second chemical that hangs around that makes it really tricky. But the reason I think that, or my history, if I were going to a, you know, sleep medicine physician, if Poppleberry was a sleep doctor, and they said, you know, you mentioned how the consult would be pretty wide ranging. On the one hand, I think for people who might hear about folks with ADHD who have sleep difficulties, their reflex might be, well, what do you expect? If you're taking, you know, a powerful stimulant drug, of course, that's going to keep you up at night. But my experience has been that in my pre-treatment phase for ADHD, when I was just, you know, drinking coffee like it was my religion, but even before that, when I hadn't even drunk my first cup of coffee yet, I was always somebody that just gravitated towards staying up late. Sometimes I feel like there's something that I actually enjoy about it. It's peaceful, it's quiet. If you have a sort of, if you're someone who's very attuned to sensory stimuli, the night is a peaceful time to do your best thinking, and there's something wonderful about the night. But there's something not so wonderful when your alarm goes off in 6 hours and you have to get to bed. And I think for people who might say that, well, staying up late is just, that's a preference, haven't really had an experience like this where you have to go to school every morning on 6 or 5 hours of sleep, which was how I kind of spent most of my teenage years. So you mentioned in the context of sleep medicine that circadian disorders were a thing. And I looked into that a little bit, and I saw that there's some controversy within the world of sleep medicine about the extent to which these are self-standing disorders, but I do find I've always thought it would be something worth learning a little bit about, because sleep hygiene is important. We've talked about colors, screen time, blue light, all that stuff. But like everything, there's people who will do everything to, you know, put the cards of the world in their favor if against depression, and they're still depressed. I think you have people who they can maintain perfect sleep hygiene, but they're still just going to be a night owl. And that can be, I think it's one of those things that is maybe can be brushed off as part of your personality when you're growing up. But as life obligations become increasingly onerous, you've got children, you've got jobs, you have to get it in order. So Herman and Corn, this has been a long intro, but I wanted to give you my story. Let's talk about true disorders of circadian regulation. We've seen a few different labels used about circadian drift, which really connects with me. The idea that you kind of naturally, your bedtime gets later and later, or just people who have what seems like a defective circadian clock in which they feel like the whatever time they're sleeping at is fine. Something that I would observe about my own sleep, and I'll finish here, is that you mentioned yesterday that people with circadian issues often feel fine. It's just that they sleep at the wrong time. And that's been pretty much my experience. There were, you know, brief times in my life when I was going to bed super late, let's say 4 a.m. And I'd feel, if it wasn't for the fact that that's a total offset against society, when I was a student, I would say that I feel fine. It's just that I feel well rested, decently rested. It's just that I can't sleep at these hours. So let's talk about circadian regulation in adults, Herman and Corn. Is it a recognized thing within sleep medicine? And for those who really do struggle, there is prescription melatonin, which people have hit and miss success with. But there's, of course, non-drug treatments as well. What do all the options look like in this important part of the experience of being human?
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a bit of a personal one this time. He's been tapering off Seroquel, down to 25 milligrams, which he says doctors dismiss as microscopic, but he definitely feels it. And he's been thinking about something we touched on yesterday. The idea that some people aren't just night owls by preference, they might have an actual circadian rhythm disorder. His question is that a recognized thing within sleep medicine? And if so, what do the treatment options actually look like? Not just prescription melatonin, but the full landscape of non-drug approaches do. And he mentions this concept of circadian drift, where your bedtime just keeps creeping later and later, which he says really connects with his own experience.
Yeah, and I should say, this is exactly the kind of thing a proper sleep medicine consult would dig into, and it's worth taking seriously because the circadian disorders are absolutely recognized. They're in the official diagnostic manual. The American Academy of Sleep Medicine has a whole classification system for them. But here's what I think most people don't realize. The field is tiny. There are roughly 7,000 board-certified sleep medicine physicians in the entire United States. To put that in perspective, there are more than 30,000 practicing dermatologists. So you've got this massive mismatch between how common sleep problems are and how few specialists exist to treat them.
That's a striking ratio. And I imagine most of those 7,000 are pulmonologists who spend their days reading sleep apnea studies, not sitting down with someone who can't fall asleep before 4 a.m.
Sleep medicine is a subspecialty, which means you come to it through a parent specialty. Usually, pulmonology, neurology, psychiatry, or sometimes internal medicine or pediatrics. And that parent specialty shaped how you think about sleep. A pulmonologist is wired to look for breathing problems. A neurologist thinks about brain mechanisms. A psychiatrist is attuned to mood and anxiety. So the frame you bring matters enormously. And for someone with a circadian issue, the ideal person might be a neurologist-trained sleep specialist. But good luck finding one who's taking new patients and takes your insurance.
This connects to something Daniel mentioned. He said even people who seem to have nothing to do with sleep, like dentists making oral appliances for apnea, are increasingly part of the conversation, which on one hand broadens the treatment path, but on the other hand makes it more diffuse. You don't always know whose door to knock on.
The fragmentation is real. A dentist can spot signs of sleep apnea from tooth grinding and jaw structure, but they're not going to diagnose a circadian rhythm disorder. An ENT might address airway obstruction, but won't ask about your melatonin onset timing. So you've got all these partial entry points and no clear front door for a lot of patients.
Before we go further, quick note, today's episode is powered by DeepSeek V4 Pro, which is writing our script. So if anything sounds unusually coherent, now you know why.
I was going to say, this feels suspiciously well structured.
Don't get used to it. So, let's talk about what circadian rhythm disorders actually are, because I think the terminology gets thrown around loosely. You hear people say, I'm a night owl, or my circadian rhythm is off, but the clinical picture is more specific.
Much more specific. The umbrella term is circadian rhythm sleep-wake disorders, and the American Academy of Sleep Medicine updated their clinical practice guideline on this just a couple of years ago. The key one for what Daniel is describing is called delayed sleep-wake phase disorder, DS, WPD, and this is not just preferring to stay up late. The diagnostic criteria are pretty clear. You have a chronic pattern where your sleep onset and wake time are delayed by at least 2 hours relative to what's considered conventional or what your life demands. And here's the crucial part. When you are allowed to sleep on your own schedule, your sleep quality and duration are actually normal. It's the misalignment with society that causes the problem.
That last point is what Daniel zeroed in on. He said there were times as a student when he was going to bed at 4 in the morning and felt decently rested. It was just that he couldn't sleep at conventional hours. So that maps perfectly.
And that's what distinguishes a circadian disorder from insomnia. In insomnia, you have difficulty sleeping even when the opportunity is there. With delayed sleep-wake phase disorder, if you let the person sleep from, say, 2 in the morning until 10 in the morning, they sleep fine. The problem is the world expects them to be asleep by 11 and awake by 7.
The pathology is in the timing mechanism, not in the sleep generation mechanism.
And that timing mechanism is incredibly complex. You've got this master clock in the brain, the suprachiasmatic nucleus in the hypothalamus, a cluster of about 20,000 neurons that oscillate on a roughly 24-hour cycle. But here's what's fascinating. That cycle is not exactly 24 hours. In most humans, the intrinsic period is about 24.2 hours. So if you put someone in a cave with no light cues, their sleep-wake cycle will drift about 12 minutes later every single day.
We're all naturally inclined to drift later. The default human setting is to be slightly delayed.
And the reason we don't all drift into nocturnal chaos is that light exposure, particularly morning light, resets the clock every day. It's called entrainment. Morning light hits specialized cells in the retina, not the rods and cones you use for vision, but a separate system called intrinsically photosensitive retinal ganglion cells. They detect light and send a signal directly to that master clock saying, it's morning, reset the phase. Without that signal, you drift.
Which means the night owl problem is essentially a failure of that reset mechanism. Either you're not getting enough light at the right time, or your clock is less responsive to it, or you're getting light at the wrong time, like screen exposure late at night. That's pushing the clock in the opposite direction.
This is where the genetics get interesting. There's a gene called CRY1 cryptochrome circadian regulator 1, and mutations in this gene are associated with familial delayed sleep phase disorder. A study from Rockefeller University a few years back found that people with certain CRY1 variants have an intrinsic circadian period that's significantly longer than average, sometimes closer to 25 hours, and this runs in families. So when Daniel says he was always someone who gravitated toward staying up late, even before he ever touched coffee or ADHD medication, that's not just a personality quirk. There may well be a biological substrate there.
That's validating, I'd imagine, for people who've been told their whole lives that they just lack discipline, or they're lazy, or they need better sleep hygiene. You can do everything right and still have a clock that's fundamentally set to a different time zone.
That's the controversy Daniel alluded to. Within sleep medicine, there has been some debate about the extent to which these are standalone disorders versus extreme ends of normal variation. The counter-argument goes, well, before electric light, most people went to bed shortly after sunset and woke around dawn, so maybe this is just a modern mismatch between our biology and our technology. But the familial patterns and the genetic evidence suggest there's more to it than that. The latest international classification of sleep disorders, the ICSD-3 text revision, recognizes delayed sleep-wake phase disorder as a distinct diagnosis. The debate isn't really about whether it exists, it's about where you draw the boundary.
There's also something called non-24-hour sleep-wake disorder, which is even more extreme. That's where the circadian clock is completely unmoored from the 24-hour day and just free runs.
Right, and that one is most commonly associated with totally blind people because they lack the light input pathway entirely. Without any light perception, the master clock can't entrain, and you get this relentless drift. It can occur in sighted people too, though it's much rarer. What Daniel described, the idea of circadian drift where bedtime gets later and later, that's more characteristic of delayed sleep-wake phase disorder that isn't being managed. Each night, you go to bed a bit later because your natural period is longer than 24 hours, and without a strong morning anchor, you just keep slipping.
Let's get to the practical question. What does treatment actually look like? Not just take melatonin and avoid screens, but the full clinical approach.
The first-line treatments are behavioral, and they're actually quite effective when done properly. The cornerstone is chronotherapy. And I should clarify, there are two different things that go by that name. The older version is a behavioral chronotherapy where you systematically delay your bedtime by 2 to 3 hours each night until you've cycled all the way around to a desired schedule. So, if you're falling asleep at 4 in the morning, you push to 7, then 10, then 1 in the afternoon, and you keep going until you land at 11 at night. It works, but it's incredibly disruptive. You essentially have to check out of normal life for a week or more to do it.
That sounds like jet lag as a medical treatment.
It basically is, and the relapse rate is high because as soon as you stop the strict scheduling, your natural tendency to drift reasserts itself. The more modern approach is timed light therapy combined with timed melatonin. And the timing here is absolutely critical, more critical than most people realize.
This is where I think the popular understanding gets it wrong. People think melatonin is a sleep aid, like a natural Ambien, but that's not what it's doing in this context.
No, it's not. Melatonin is a chronobiotic. It's a phase-shifting agent. It tells your brain what time it is, and the direction of the phase shift depends entirely on when you take it. If you take melatonin in the early evening, several hours before your natural melatonin onset, it advances your clock. It makes you sleepy earlier. If you take it in the morning, it delays your clock. Most people don't know this. They take melatonin 30 minutes before they want to sleep, which is basically using it as a mild hypnotic, not as a circadian reset tool.
For someone with delayed sleep-wake phase disorder, the protocol would be low-dose melatonin taken in the early evening, paired with bright light exposure first thing in the morning.
That's the standard approach, and the dose matters enormously. The studies show that for phase shifting, lower doses are actually more effective than higher doses. We're talking about 0.5 milligrams to 3 milligrams, taken about 5 to 7 hours before the natural melatonin onset, which for someone with delayed phase might be midnight or later. So you'd take it around 6 or 7 in the evening. Meanwhile, in the morning, you need bright light, ideally 10,000 lux for 30 minutes, which is the output of a clinical light box, as close to your target wake time as possible. The light suppresses any residual melatonin and sends a strong phase, advancing signal to the master clock.
This is where the compliance challenge comes in. If your natural tendency is to sleep until noon, forcing yourself up at 7 to sit in front of a bright light is genuinely difficult. You're fighting your biology.
It's brutal in the first week. And that's why the clinical guidelines emphasize that this needs to be done under supervision, ideally with a sleep specialist who can adjust the timing based on how you're responding. You can't just buy a light box on Amazon and figure it out yourself. Well, you can, and people do, but the success rates are much lower without proper guidance on timing and duration.
Let's talk about prescription melatonin versus over-the-counter. Daniel mentioned that people have hit and miss success with it, and I think part of that is the regulatory mess around melatonin supplements.
It's a complete mess. In the United States, melatonin is classified as a dietary supplement, which means it's not subject to the same quality control as prescription drugs. A study from a few years back tested 30 commercial melatonin supplements and found that the actual melatonin content varied from 83% less to 478% more than what was on the label. Some of them also contain serotonin, which is a neurotransmitter, not something you want to be taking as a supplement without knowing about it.
You might think you're taking 3 milligrams and actually getting 14, or essentially nothing.
And that variability alone explains a lot of the hit-and-miss experiences. But there's also a prescription version, Remeltion, brand name Roserum, which is a melatonin receptor agonist. It binds to the same receptors in the brain that melatonin does, but it's a regulated pharmaceutical with consistent dosing. It's approved for insomnia, not specifically for circadian rhythm disorders, but it's sometimes used off-label. The advantage is reliability. The disadvantage is cost and insurance coverage.
What about the other prescription options? I know there's been some excitement about orexin antagonists.
The orexin antagonists. Drugs like suvorexant, brand name Belsomra, and the newer ones like daridorexant and lemborexant. Those are a different category entirely. They're hypnotics, not chronobiotics. They work by blocking orexin, a neuropeptide that promotes wakefulness. They're essentially turning down the wakefulness signal rather than turning up the sleep signal. For someone with a circadian disorder, they might help you fall asleep at your desired bedtime, but they're not fixing the underlying clock misalignment. They're a symptomatic treatment, not a phase-resetting one.
You might sleep, but your body still thinks it's the wrong time.
And that's an important distinction. Sleep achieved through orexin blockade is closer to natural sleep than what you get with traditional sedatives like benzodiazepines or Z-drugs because it's not forcing sedation, it's just reducing the drive to be awake. But it's still not addressing the circadian timing issue. For delayed sleep-wake phase disorder specifically, the clinical guidelines recommend timed melatonin and light therapy as first line, and they recommend against using hypnotics as a primary treatment.
There's also a device-based approach that I think is underappreciated. Wearable light exposure trackers combined with algorithmic recommendations.
This is actually where some of the most interesting innovation is happening. There are research-grade devices that measure your light exposure across the full 24-hour cycle and model your circadian phase in real time. Based on that model, the app can tell you exactly when to seek light and when to avoid it. The mathematical models behind this are derived from something called the Kronauer model, a differential equation model of the human circadian pacemaker that's been validated in dozens of studies.
This is where I think Daniel's intuition about AI being useful for waypointing comes in. You've got a complex system with multiple inputs. Light timing, intensity, spectrum, melatonin timing, meal timing, exercise timing. And the optimal combination varies from person to person. A human clinician can give you general guidelines, but something that tracks your actual data and adjusts recommendations in real time could be more precise.
I think that's right, with the caveat that most consumer devices on the market are not doing rigorous circadian phase estimation. They're using proxy measures like heart rate variability or movement patterns, which correlate loosely with circadian phase but aren't the same thing. The research-grade stuff uses core body temperature or salivary melatonin measurements, which are much more accurate, but also much more invasive. So there's a gap between what's scientifically validated and what's commercially available.
Let's talk about something Daniel mentioned that I think is worth pulling apart, the relationship between ADHD and circadian disruption. He said people might reflexively assume that if you're on stimulants, of course you can't sleep. But his experience was that the night owl tendency preceded any medication, and even preceded coffee.
There's a substantial literature on this. The comorbidity between ADHD and delayed sleep-wake phase disorder is remarkably high. Some studies put it at around 25 to 50% of adults with ADHD having clinically significant delayed sleep phase. And it's not just a medication side effect, though stimulants can certainly exacerbate it if taken too late in the day. The relationship appears to be bidirectional and probably shares some underlying neurobiology. Dopamine is involved in both attention regulation and circadian regulation. There's also evidence that the same clock genes I mentioned, CRY1 and another one called PER3, are implicated in both conditions.
It's not that ADHD causes sleep problems or that sleep problems cause ADHD symptoms. It's more that they're tangled up at a deeper level.
Right, and this has clinical implications. If you treat the ADHD with stimulants but ignore the circadian disorder, you might get partial improvement in attention but continued impairment from chronic sleep restriction. Conversely, if you treat the circadian disorder with chronotherapy but ignore the ADHD, the executive function demands of maintaining a strict light and melatonin schedule might be too high for the patient to sustain. You really need to address both.
Which brings us back to the access problem. The number of clinicians who are competent in both ADHD and circadian sleep disorders is vanishingly small. You're looking at someone who's trained in psychiatry, did a sleep medicine fellowship, and has kept up with both literatures. That's a unicorn.
It is a unicorn. And this is where the fragmentation of sleep medicine really hurts patients. If you come in through psychiatry, you might get your ADHD managed well, but your circadian assessment might be superficial. Try to go to bed earlier, avoid screens. If you come in through a sleep center, you might get a proper circadian workup, but the psychiatrist who manages your ADHD isn't looped in, and the sleep specialist might not feel comfortable adjusting your stimulant timing.
Daniel also mentioned the pharmacokinetics of Seroquel. He's tapering, and he's at 25 milligrams, and he said our discussion of the metabolite effect made him feel less crazy for finding this last bit so difficult.
This is worth explaining briefly because it's a perfect example of why tapering isn't linear. Seroquel quetiapine has a primary metabolite called norquetiapine that has a much longer half-life than the parent drug. Quetiapine itself has a half-life of about 6 to 7 hours. Norquetiapine hangs around for roughly 12 hours. At higher doses, quetiapine acts primarily on dopamine and serotonin receptors, which is why it's used for schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. But at very low doses, like 25 milligrams, it's primarily hitting histamine H1 receptors, which is profoundly sedating. So that 25 milligram dose isn't microscopic in its sleep effects at all. It's actually right in the sweet spot for histamine blockade.
When you've been taking it for a long time, your brain is adapted to that histamine blockade. You've upregulated histamine signaling to compensate. When you remove the drug, you've got a histamine system that's running hot, and that feels like insomnia on steroids.
And the metabolite norquetiapine adds a complicating factor because it's still active even after the parent drug has cleared. So the withdrawal isn't just from quetiapine, it's from two active compounds with different half-lives. This is why slow tapers are essential, and why the last step from 25 milligrams to zero is often the hardest. You're not just removing a small amount of drug, you're removing the last bit of histamine blockade that your brain has come to depend on.
That's the kind of pharmacological detail that a general practitioner might not think about, and even a psychiatrist might not prioritize if they're not specifically focused on sleep.
This is the argument for seeing a sleep medicine physician who has a strong pharmacology background. But again, access. Most people taper off these medications with minimal guidance, or with guidance from a prescriber who means well but doesn't have deep expertise in the receptor-level dynamics of sleep-wake regulation.
Let's circle back to the non-drug treatments for circadian disorders. We've talked about light therapy and timed melatonin. What about temperature manipulation? I've read that core body temperature is tightly coupled to the circadian rhythm.
Your core body temperature drops as you approach your natural sleep onset, and it rises again shortly before you wake up. You can use this to help shift your rhythm. A warm bath about 90 minutes before your target bedtime can actually help advance your sleep phase. The mechanism is interesting. The warm water causes peripheral vasodilation. Your blood vessels near the skin dilate, which allows heat to dissipate from your core. That drop in core temperature is a signal to the brain that it's time to sleep. So you're essentially hacking your own thermoregulatory system to send a sleep signal.
A hot bath before bed isn't just relaxing. It's thermoregulatory manipulation.
And the timing matters. If you take a hot bath right before you get into bed, it can actually be counterproductive because your core temperature is still elevated. You need that 90-minute window for the heat to dissipate and the core temperature to drop. This is well studied. There's a meta-analysis from the journal Sleep Medicine Reviews that found warm baths or showers 1 to 2 hours before bedtime significantly improved sleep onset latency and increased slow-wave sleep.
What about meal timing? I've seen claims that when you eat can shift your circadian rhythm almost as much as when you see light.
There's good evidence for this, though the effect size is smaller than light. The basic idea is that food is a Zeitgeber, a time giver, for peripheral clocks in your liver, pancreas, and gut. Your master clock in the brain is primarily entrained by light, but these peripheral clocks are entrained by feeding. When you eat late at night, you're telling your liver and pancreas that it's still daytime, which creates a misalignment between the master clock and the peripheral clocks. This is sometimes called internal desynchrony, and it's associated with metabolic problems, insulin resistance, weight gain, and so on.
For someone trying to advance their sleep phase, you'd want to shift meal timing earlier as well.
And breakfast is particularly important. Eating shortly after your target wake time reinforces the morning signal to those peripheral clocks. Skipping breakfast and eating late at night is essentially sending a constant "it's evening" signal to your metabolic systems, which works against any phase advancing you're trying to do with light and melatonin.
I want to talk about something Daniel mentioned that I think gets at a deeper question. He said there's something he actually enjoys about the night. The peace, the quiet, the freedom from sensory stimuli. For someone who's very attuned to sensory input, the night is a refuge. And I wonder if treating the circadian disorder sometimes means losing something that people value.
That's a really important point, and it's one that clinicians sometimes miss. If you've built your identity and your creative life around those quiet nocturnal hours, being told to shift to a morning schedule can feel like being told to become a different person. The night owl identity isn't just a sleep pattern. It's a relationship with solitude, with uninterrupted thought, with a certain kind of stillness that doesn't exist during the day.
For someone like Daniel, who works in tech and does open source development, those late night hours might be when he does his best work. The cost of fixing the sleep schedule might be a real creative cost.
I think the clinical approach needs to acknowledge this. The goal isn't necessarily to turn a night owl into a morning lark. It's to achieve enough phase advancement that the person can meet their life obligations without chronic sleep deprivation. If your natural sleep window is 2 in the morning until 10 in the morning, and you can arrange your work and family life around that, then maybe you don't need treatment at all. The disorder label only applies when there's clinically significant distress or impairment. If you're sleeping well and functioning well, even on a delayed schedule, that's not a disorder. That's just a chronotype.
Most people can't arrange their lives that way. They've got jobs that start at 9, kids who need to be at school by 8, meetings that happen during business hours. The impairment isn't from the sleep pattern itself. It's from the collision between the sleep pattern and the social schedule.
And that collision has real health consequences. Chronic sleep restriction, which is what you get when your circadian rhythm says sleep until 10, but your alarm says wake up at 7, is associated with increased risk of cardiovascular disease, metabolic disorders, impaired immune function, and cognitive deficits. A large study from the UK Biobank a few years back found that people with a definite evening chronotype had a 10% higher risk of all-cause mortality compared to definite morning types, even after controlling for sleep duration and other health behaviors.
10% is not trivial.
It's not. And the leading hypothesis is that the increased risk comes from the chronic misalignment between biological time and social time, what researchers call social jet lag. It's not that being a night owl is inherently unhealthy. It's that being a night owl in a morning lark world means you're constantly fighting your own biology.
What does the ideal clinical pathway look like? If someone like Daniel could wave a magic wand and get the perfect sleep medicine consult, what would happen?
A proper sleep medicine evaluation for suspected circadian rhythm disorder would start with a detailed history, and I mean detailed. Not just what time do you go to bed, but a sleep diary kept for at least 2 weeks, ideally with actigraphy. Actigraphy is a wrist-worn device that measures movement and light exposure. It's not as comprehensive as a full polysomnogram, the overnight sleep study with all the electrodes, but for circadian disorders, it's actually more useful because it captures patterns over multiple days in the person's natural environment.
You're getting a picture of the actual sleep-wake rhythm, not just a one-night snapshot in a lab.
The sleep diary and actigraphy together can reveal whether there's a consistent phase delay, whether there's drift from day to day, and whether there are other issues like irregular sleep-wake patterns or insufficient sleep. The clinician might also do something called a dim light melatonin onset test, DLMO, where they measure melatonin levels in saliva or blood in the evening under controlled low-light conditions. This gives you an objective measure of where the person's circadian phase actually is.
Then from that data, you build a treatment plan.
The plan would typically start with the behavioral interventions we talked about, timed light exposure in the morning, timed melatonin in the evening, and consistent sleep-wake scheduling 7 days a week. That last part is crucial, and it's where a lot of people fail. If you shift your schedule during the week, but then revert to your natural late pattern on weekends, you're essentially giving yourself jet lag every Monday morning. The clinical term for that is social jet lag, and it undermines the phase advancement you're trying to achieve.
The weekend sabotage is real. I think a lot of people don't realize how fragile the circadian entrainment is. 2 days of sleeping in can undo 5 days of disciplined early rising.
It absolutely can. And the clinical guidelines emphasize that consistency across all 7 days is one of the strongest predictors of treatment success. It's also one of the hardest things to achieve because it means giving up the weekend sleep-in, which for many people is the only time they feel rested.
The treatment is effective but demanding, and the access to specialists who can guide it properly is limited. That's a frustrating combination.
And I think this is where Daniel's point about AI waypointing has real merit. If you could have a system that takes your actigraphy data, your sleep diary, and maybe some occasional melatonin sampling, and uses that to generate a personalized phase-shifting protocol, when to get light, when to avoid light, when to take melatonin, when to eat, when to exercise, that could potentially be more precise than what a human clinician can do with a once every 3 months 15-minute follow-up.
The human clinician still needs to be in the loop for the big decisions. Diagnosis, ruling out other conditions, managing comorbidities, adjusting medications. But the day-to-day optimization of circadian entrainment is exactly the kind of thing an algorithmic system could handle well.
This isn't science fiction. There are research groups at Stanford, at the University of Michigan, at the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research that are developing exactly these kinds of systems. The military has a strong interest in this because they need to manage circadian disruption in deployed personnel. The models are quite sophisticated. They can predict your circadian phase based on your light exposure history with fairly high accuracy, and they can generate countermeasure recommendations that are personalized to your individual circadian parameters.
The civilian applications are obvious. Shift workers, frequent travelers, adolescents with delayed sleep phase, older adults with advanced sleep phase. But the commercialization has been slow, partly because the regulatory pathway for software as medical device is still evolving.
Partly because the business model isn't obvious. A one-time purchase app that tells you when to get light exposure is hard to monetize at a level that justifies the research and development costs. A subscription model for sleep optimization might work, but you'd need to demonstrate outcomes that justify the recurring cost.
Let me ask you something about the diagnostic category itself. Daniel mentioned there's some controversy within sleep medicine about whether circadian disorders are standalone conditions. I know the ICSD recognizes them, but is there still active debate, or has that mostly been settled?
The debate has shifted. It used to be about whether these were real disorders at all. Now the debate is more nuanced. It's about whether we're over-medicalizing normal chronotype variation. The concern is that if you label anyone who prefers to stay up late as having a disorder, you pathologize a normal variant of human biology. The counter-argument is that when the mismatch between chronotype and social schedule causes clinically significant impairment, it meets the definition of a disorder regardless of whether the underlying chronotype is normal. Both positions have merit.
It's similar to the debate about whether ADHD is a disorder or just an extreme of normal attentional variation. The line between temperament and pathology is fuzzy.
It's fuzzier still when you consider cultural context. In some cultures, the siesta culture means biphasic sleep is normalized and late bedtimes are less problematic. In others, the workday starts at 7 in the morning and there's zero flexibility. The same chronotype that's functional in one setting is disabling in another. That doesn't mean the disorder isn't real. It means the disorder is defined in part by the environment.
Before we wrap, I want to touch on something Daniel mentioned about sleep hygiene. He said, and I'm paraphrasing, you can do everything right and still be depressed, and similarly, you can have perfect sleep hygiene and still be a night owl. I think that's an important point because sleep hygiene has become this catch-all recommendation that sometimes blames the patient for not trying hard enough.
Sleep hygiene is necessary but not sufficient for circadian disorders. Avoiding caffeine in the evening, keeping the bedroom dark and cool, having a consistent bedtime routine, all of that is good practice, but it's not going to fix a fundamentally delayed circadian phase. It's like telling someone with clinical depression to just think positive thoughts. It's not wrong. A positive mindset helps, but it's not treating the underlying neurobiology.
It can actually be harmful when it's presented as the solution, because when it doesn't work, the patient concludes that they're failing or that their problem is intractable. They don't realize that what they actually need is a fundamentally different category of intervention.
That's a really important point. Sleep hygiene is about optimizing the conditions for sleep. Circadian interventions are about shifting the timing of the sleep-wake cycle. They're different things operating at different levels. If your problem is timing, no amount of blackout curtains and white noise machines is going to fix it.
All right, let's try to pull this together. For someone like Daniel, a night owl since adolescence, currently tapering off a sedating medication, wondering if there's a circadian disorder component, what's the practical takeaway?
First, yes, circadian rhythm sleep-wake disorders are recognized clinical entities with established diagnostic criteria and evidence-based treatments. Second, the most effective treatments are behavioral. Timed bright light in the morning, timed low-dose melatonin in the early evening, and rigid sleep-wake scheduling 7 days a week. Third, access to specialists who can properly diagnose and guide this treatment is limited, which makes self-education important but also risky if you get the timing wrong. Fourth, the ADHD connection is real and bidirectional. Treating one without the other often fails.
Fifth, the fact that you feel fine when sleeping on your own delayed schedule is actually diagnostically informative. It's one of the features that distinguishes a circadian disorder from insomnia.
If you can sleep well when left to your own devices, your sleep generation mechanism is intact. The problem is the clock, not the sleep drive.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The national animal of Scotland is the unicorn. Scotland adopted the unicorn as its national animal in the 1300s, and it appears on the royal coat of arms of the United Kingdom alongside the English lion. The unicorn is traditionally depicted in chains because medieval bestiaries claimed it was the most dangerous creature alive and could only be captured by a virgin maiden.
Scotland's national animal is imaginary and in chains. That feels like a metaphor for something, but I'm not sure what.
I have so many questions, and I'm choosing to ask none of them.
To close out, I think the big open question here is whether the coming generation of digital circadian assessment tools actually closes the access gap, or just creates a two-tier system where people who can afford the devices and the subscriptions get precision chronotherapy and everyone else gets told to avoid blue light. The science is solid, the treatments work, but the delivery system is broken, and technology could fix it or could make the inequity worse.
For Daniel specifically, if you're at the tail end of a Seroquel taper and you're also dealing with what sounds like a lifelong delayed sleep phase, those are two separate things that are probably amplifying each other. The taper will eventually end, and when it does, the circadian pattern that was there before the medication will still be there. That's the thing to get evaluated, ideally with someone who understands both the pharmacology and the chronobiology. They're just hard to find.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. This has been My Weird Prompts. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. Good night or good morning, depending on your chronotype.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.